Sorry for that awkward beginning. Welcome again to St. Andrews. Lots of stuff to talk about in these lessons. The story of Esau and Jacob, the parable of the sower and its accompanying allegorical interpretation, and then Paul laying before us some very difficult, very technical theological wrestling. These terms, flesh and spirit, flesh, body, and spirit, don't mean quite what they might sound like at first hearing to our modern ears. So I want to start with the story of Jacob and Esau. And not, these are part of the cycle of stories in Genesis, the sort of patriarchal history, ancient prehistory of Israel. And don't want to get into much of that, just to put before you that image of, I think the way they used to put it in the King James was, he sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. And I want to, the Bible, among other things, is part of our cultural heritage as well as our spiritual heritage. And to have this image of selling your birthright for a mess of pottage, for quite a while now, that has suggested to me any situation in which we exchange something of great value for something of lesser value. And, of course, part of where I go with that is, what is our human birthright? And one of the dilemmas or predicaments of being a human being seems always to be that we are going to accept something, a definition of ourselves or a circumstance for our employment, something that is not equal to our true stature. Part of the long-term project here is to get an accurate understanding of who God is for us and also an accurate understanding of who we are as human beings. I think both are often subject to grave, terrible distortions. And we misunderstand God. I mean, how much of Jesus' ministry was trying to help us understand who the true God is? And we also misunderstand ourselves. So I tend to think we have a profoundly high calling. I take seriously those images in the New Testament that speaks of all of us as kings and queens, royal, with the prerogatives of freedom and great dignity. But then I heard myself saying freedom and dignity, and then I thought back to B.F. Skinner's work, on behavioral sort of a vision. Who's familiar with B.F. Skinner? Goes back ways. Good. So most of us, many of us are. Anyway, he said, basically, you human beings, get over yourselves. It's freedom and dignity stuff. You're just a stimulus response machine. There's nobody home. I don't quite know what he thought he was doing, when he was developing these theories. But anyway, that would be, to accept a definition of the human being like that would be to sell your birthright for a mess of pottage. You'd be going below yourself. You would be giving away your deep dignity, the beauty of being human, for something far less. So that's all I want to say. Just, he sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. Are you acting in accord with your own high calling? So that's Jacob and Esau. We're going to jump to the sower, the parable of the sower. Not going to say too much about it for a couple of reasons. There are those who say this parable is quite actually straightforward. It could be called the parable of the prodigal sower. Just seeds scattered everywhere, path, rocks, thorns, and some in the good soil. And there are some who say the real meaning of this is simply that whatever God is intending will not be thwarted. God's seed, the seed that is spread upon creation, will bring forth fruit, will not be thwarted. But you'll notice that this parable has a second part to it. It's an explanation. Hear then the parable of the sower. This means this. This means this. The this means this, which is, of course, the structure of an allegory. But rather, instead of talking about it in literary terms, think of it like a joke. I've always thought parables were meant to be understood sort of like jokes. You get them in that rush of insight that, with a joke, makes you laugh. Now, woe to the teller of jokes who has to explain the joke and tell people why it was funny. And this is pretty much what's going on in the second half of this so-called parable. Again, focus on the first part and just let those images speak to you and wrestle with them and come to your own understanding of what it might be for seed to be spread wantonly and yet produce good fruit. But there is a part of this allegorical explanation that I want to lean on a little bit. Partly because, you know, here's the one who's too concerned for wealth and so choked, or he had no depth of soil. And the question is almost inescapable. You know, am I good soil? Am I rocky soil? Am I thorny soil? Am I... One of the things I think most of us struggle with is that when we turn to the Bible and so much of the Bible's language, we feel like we're going to be accused of something. And I thought of this book. It's recently published. I can't remember the authors, but the title of the book is God is Disappointed in You. I'm not going to try to explain that, but you're not laughing, and I don't quite know why. And the sense of God is disappointed in you, for many people, pretty much encapsulates what the Bible is about. You turn to the Bible to find out how you have failed, what you've done wrong, how God is disappointed in you. And much of what Paul is talking about, you know, those whose minds are set on the flesh cannot please God. You know, we hear that language, to please God, and it just kind of sets us back a little bit. And there's a part of me that I don't want to do that. Except all of the language that has to do with the way of sin and death, or the way of pleasing God. What we have to remember about these things is that they are genuinely and authentically for our benefit. In fact, God is not disappointed in us. God loves us. And Paul talks about the spirit of the one who raised Jesus from the dead being within us. I've spoken of that in recent weeks as a kind of benevolent mirror in which we can see a true picture of ourselves. If we want to see a true picture of ourselves, the Spirit of God who dwells within us will show us to that, not, as the first line of our reading from Paul today says, not to condemn us. There is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. There, you know, as Jesus said, I come not to judge the world. I come not to condemn the world, but to save the world. Genuinely for our benefit. And so the tension, I think, that Paul is trying to set up is the way of sin and death. You could think of that really as the way of unhappiness. What are the things that you do that genuinely make you unhappy? The things you surrender to the temptation of anxiety. You lose perspective. You seek. You compare yourself. You're too concerned with yourself. You act selfishly. What are the things that you do that make you or those around you unhappy? That's what Paul would talk about as the way of sin and death. And It's not like God is standing somewhere off in the distance saying, oh, well, you're following the way of sin and death. You're going to be unhappy and you're going to be punished. No, it's that you're unhappy and you're making other people unhappy. And the way of the Spirit, the way of the Spirit is the way of happiness. It's the way of genuine happiness, not like trying to please some demanding parent whose demands can never be fulfilled. It's the real way of happiness. And so Paul is working with these terms. And when we hear flesh, it's not this. It's not my skin and bones. When Paul talks about the way of flesh, he's talking about a theological domain. He's talking about the way, the domain of unhappiness. And I'll present this. I'll see what you think of this. There's a paradox at work here. He contrasts the way of spirit, the way of flesh. The way of flesh, you might think, oh, just focused on sex or something. Not at all. The way of flesh is a spiritual attitude. And that attitude has to do with this. I don't accept the conditions of my human existence. I don't like being powerless. I don't like the uncertainty of the future. I don't like my vulnerability. I don't like that I age. And I especially don't like that I die. I don't like any of it. The way of flesh sees all of that and says, I'm going to try to figure out some way of distancing myself, rectifying it, getting out of this situation. That's what the way of flesh is. A basic refusal of the conditions of our everyday life. And the way of spirit, by contrast, again, it's not really, you know, ethereal, I'm just going to think of disembodied things. Not at all. The way of spirit, rather, is surrender completely to the conditions of this life, accepts it all. You could say the word for the way of spirit is to become incarnate, to enter into the body with all its vulnerabilities, all its uncertainties, all of it, and say, thank you for the gift of this embodiment, this life. Thank you for that. So, the way of flesh, running away. The way of spirit, deeply surrendered. Finally, you know, Paul talks about the Spirit of God, and if the Spirit of the one who raised Jesus from the dead, it makes it sound as if some have the Spirit of God and some don't. And you would know me by now well enough to understand that I believe everyone, every creature, participates in the living Spirit of God. We would not exist if God's presence were withdrawn for us or from us. And so, really, the question is, are we aware of that Spirit in us? Are we aware of it? Do we pay attention to it? Do we listen to it? Do we allow the Spirit of God to prompt our hearts into a way of seeing things that sets us on a true path of happiness? Do we allow that? Do we understand that every person we meet already is gifted with the Spirit of God? They might not be aware of it. We might not be aware of it in that moment. But that's part of the rhythm of our life. We remember, we forget. We remember, we forget. We stray, we come back. And what we come back to is our true birthright. The birthright of being bearers of the Spirit of God. Little creatures on a small planet in a large universe. Bearers of the Spirit of the One who called all of this into existence. It is a high calling. And help each other remember it and do the things in your life that will help you remember it as well.